Welcome to the Bogosity Podcast for the 1st of July 2013, the podcast that always races ipsa loquitur. One day we'll beat her. This is your host, Shane Killian, and this week it's our Supreme Court special, looking at several notable decisions delivered this past week by the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining me once again are Jonathan Lochey and Tim Dyson. Glad to have you back, guys.
Great to be back.
Good to be on again.
Well, there were actually 14 decisions they delivered in the past week, but that really isn't that unusual. Most of what the Supreme Court does is rule on legal technicalities and decide cases that don't really matter that much to anyone other than the parties involved. It's just these few that get all the attention because they have these important constitutional decisions or these far-reaching implications. But this past week, there were, I think, six of them worth discussing. And I have to say, I'm actually pretty pleased with the way a lot of these turned out.
Yeah, none of them were the quite soul-crushing, depressing. The Affordable Care Act is legal because it's actually a tax, even though when it passed it, that was not even once considered a tax.
Or they can use your silence against you, like I reported last week.
Yeah, but even the ones that are good, there's some dark sides to them, but we'll get to that when we get there.
So what I thought we'd do is we'd look at each of these, and then I thought we'd score the different justices based on how well we think they did. So if we think they made a good decision, we'll give them a plus one, and a bad decision will be a minus one. Like if we agree with the decision, all of the ones who voted for will give them plus one, and the ones who voted against will give them the minus one, or vice versa. And then we'll see how they all stack up at the end.
May the best win, then.
Now, I know I keep saying Supreme Court decisions are a coin toss, but sometimes the coin just goes the right way for a little bit. So let's start with Vance versus Ball State University. This centers around the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and one of the sections says basically that employers can't discriminate against their employees due to race or whatever. Now, if the discrimination is done by a supervisor, the employee has standing to sue in civil court, but not if it's a coworker that has no power over them. Then they can only sue if they complain to their employer and nothing gets done about it. So the question before the court here is, who counts as a supervisor? So this happened when an African-American employee of Ball State University said she was a victim of discrimination because the person doing the discrimination had control over her daily activities, like what kind of work she was given and so on. But lawyers for Ball State argued it has to be someone who has some kind of tangible power over them, such as hiring and firing, or deciding whether or not to promote them. So this Supreme Court decision, it was kind of in between. The court agreed that it doesn't have to be a supervisor, it just has to be someone with control over the worker's day-to-day activities. But in this case, it wasn't enough control to count. It has to be enough control where you can actually be damaged in some way. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, and it said, quote, "If the supervisor's harassment culminates in a tangible employment action, the employer is strictly liable. But if no tangible employment action is taken, the employer may escape liability by establishing as an affirmative defense that, one, the employer exercised reasonable care to prevent and correct any harassing behavior, and two, that the plaintiff unreasonably failed to take advantage of the preventive or corrective opportunities that the employer provided."
Yeah, discrimination is one of those issues that it's very misunderstood by a lot of people. Like, it means more than a lot of people think it does. When you think discrimination, you think, oh, bad people hating other people for just because of how they look or things like that. But there's really more to it than that. And you run into the problem of having to balance this with the with freedom of association, as you pointed out before.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea here in civil court is that it's not so much, oh, they discriminated against, or we're just going to go after them. The person has to show in civil court that they've been damaged in some way by the discrimination. They've been put under some kind of stress, or they've lost money they would otherwise have earned, or whatever.
The interesting thing is, if the economy wasn't doing badly as it was, if there was loss of employment available, it really would be a non-issue, because anyone subjected to that could very freely just threaten to quit and go somewhere where they'll get better treatment, so.
And the threat of that would actually incentivize employers to treat their workers better.
Does it ever elaborate exactly what happened? Because I really get annoyed when I read someone says they were discriminated against and they give no details. Like, what does that even mean?
To me, it doesn't really even deal with discrimination as far as what I was reading with the decision. it was more of a technicality as to what is a quote-unquote supervisor. It doesn't even really deal with the issue of discrimination.
Yeah, that wasn't an issue before the court, and I'm looking through the decision, and I don't see where it says specifically what was going on. But they weren't saying that discrimination did or did not take place. It's, does she have standing to sue?
Yeah. I mean, a good employer will appreciate knowing about things like that, because demoralized employees hurts the bottom line, so...
So, what do you think about this decision, good or bad?
I don't really think it's really bad in any sense. Like,
do you think they made the right call?
I'll give them an incomplete on this, I think.
Yeah. I don't, without knowing exactly what happened, and whether or not it's even an issue of discrimination or just another employee who was being a jerk, there's a bit of a line between that, too.
Okay, so I guess we'll just consider this one a wash, then. But it is interesting, and it does hopefully make things clear for further cases, and I guess they're going to go back now and have the actual trial to see if there was discrimination. Next up is the case of adoptive couple versus baby girl, and that's obviously done for the sake of anonymity. Like Roe versus Wade, there was no person named Jane Roe. That was kind of like John Doe, Jane Roe kind of thing. This case involved an Oklahoma woman who gave up her baby. She gave her up for adoption after the biological father disclaimed any interest. He was estranged from the mother. There was no financial support. He never made any effort to be in the baby's life or anything like that. And so she put the child up for adoption, and then the guy objected. Now, ordinarily, at this point, the biological father would have no standing to contest the adoption, because he would be seen to have given up his right. He would have to step forward before this happened. So if that happened to any of us, there'd be nothing we could do about it. But then, we're not Native American.
Oh, there we go.
Since the father was a registered member of an Indian tribe, the lower courts ruled that the Indian Child Welfare Act meant that the father could assert his rights and stop the adoption. So this act was passed to stop social workers and other government officials from taking children away from Indian families, and this was a huge problem. It was something like a third of all families were having their children taken from them, of Indian families. And so the question before the court was, does this also extend to a couple trying to adopt a child from a parent that had previously expressed no interest in raising the child? So it's not like the case where they were thinking of when they passed the act, where you have children in a home with parents and the parents are raising the child and the government comes along and takes the child. So in the court's opinion, it said, quote, when, as here, the adoption of an Indian child is voluntarily and lawfully initiated by a non-Indian parent with sole custodial rights, the ICWA's primary goal of preventing the unwarranted removal of Indian children and the dissolution of Indian families is not implicated. And they said the act is, quote, a sensible requirement when applied to state social workers who might otherwise be too quick to remove Indian children from their Indian families. It would, however, be unusual to apply it in the context of an Indian parent who abandoned a child prior to birth and who never had custody of the child. So basically they ruled you don't get to swoop in at the 11th hour and claim the child just because you happen to be Native American. You know, the adoptive parents, they had the child, they had full custody, this guy said nothing, and then all of a sudden he comes in and does this. And they also said, quote, the majority offers the suggestion that a contrary result would create an equal protection problem. And that problem would be because, quote, it is undisputed that, had baby girl not been Cherokee, biological father would have had no right to object to her adoption under South Carolina law. So the ability to do so would have depended solely on race.
I was going to be afraid it was going to turn out to be the other way when I was reading this story.
Yeah, well, it's another 5-4 ruling. All of these we're looking at are 5-4. So really, you know, again, it's a coin toss. It could kind of go either way.
That in itself is rather disturbing.
Yeah.
It's just a different race. The circumstances are still the same. So why is that? Because governments were stealing Indian children before? Well, that's their problem. They caused that. You can't ding everyone else because of what government did.
Yeah. I misunderstood this case when I first read it, because I thought it was that the father was in some way, shape, or form involved, and because he was Native American, well, sorry, you're SOL. In the circumstances, if there was cut and dry as described in the court proceedings, then, yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. If he weren't Native American, he would be laughed out of any other court in this country.
Well, I kind of went back and forth on this because, you know, I'm a firm believer in, you know, give the biological parents a chance. You know, and I think if it were a question of the adoption laws in general and saying, you know, can a biological parent step forward and say, look, I know I've screwed up, but I've changed my mind, I've turned everything around, and I really think I can make a go at raising this child, then I think that deserves merit. But that wasn't the question before the court, and what really got me on the Supreme Court's side on this one was just when he said, if this had happened with a white biological father, he would have no standing at all, and they wouldn't have done. But just because he's a Native American, and that's what makes all the difference to me.
Yeah, ordinarily, I really detest the way courts treat fathers. But in this case, they're absolutely right to rule against him. Like, if this was really such a big issue for him, where was he for the past 9 months? It's not like he didn't know.
Yeah.
He was well aware of this. He had plenty of time, plenty of chances. At no point did he ever have any commitment to being a father here. So, no, you can't turn up at the last second like that. Children need stability. They don't need a parent who's yes, no, maybe so.
Well, Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, pointed out the same misgiving I just have. It's not right to rule against the father solely because he doesn't have custody. But it's not really what the majority was saying, because in the court's opinion they wrote, quote, "It is undisputed that for the duration of the pregnancy and the first 4 months after baby girl's birth, biological father provided no financial assistance to birth mother or baby girl, even though he had the ability to do so. Indeed, biological father made no meaningful attempts to assume his responsibility of parenthood during this period."
In short, he had his chance. He squandered it.
So are we all thinking this is a good decision then?
Most definitely.
I agree. I think with the circumstances being as they were, I do believe that the father had no legal standing.
Okay, so voting for this decision was Roberts, Alito, Kennedy, Thomas, and Breyer. And voting against, we'll get the minus one in this case, was Sotomayor, Scalia, Ginsburg, and Kagan. All right, so now let's go to Kuntz versus St. John's River Water Management District. Jonathan, I believe you had something to say about this?
I actually just came back from a little bit of a con, and this is one of the decisions we were talking about, because this was close, this is down more towards Orlando, if I remember right, but essentially what this case was boiled down to was that wetlands are a very big deal here in Florida. This guy had property that was considered wetlands. He wanted to build X amount, he wanted to develop about an acre. Essentially, to comply with various environmental regulations, Florida requires you to do some offset whatever potential environmental impact that you have. Well, in this case, they wanted him to turn over the remaining property he owned, as well as pay for various improvements to other state land.
Yeah, and this was based on two previous Supreme Court cases, Nolan versus California Coastal Commission and Dolan versus City of Tigard. And these set limits on what the government can do in such a situation. They said there had to be a rough proportionality, whatever that means, between the consequences of the land use and the measures government took to protect it. So what the Florida Supreme Court said was that the Nolan-Dolan standard doesn't apply to the denial of a permit, and it also doesn't apply to a demand for a payment of money. The Supreme Court reversed that. They said denying permits or extracting fees would create a path to circumvention, so they ruled that he does have a case, but they reserved judgment on the merits of his case. Again, they're saying he has a case and they're just kind of kicking it back to let the lower courts decide it again.
Yeah, and really essentially what the St. John's River Management District was saying, in order to build upon property you own, not only do you have to forfeit adjacent property that you also own but don't have any plans for, you also have to directly pay for this other stuff that you don't. It was, you know, we often on this podcast use the compare government to mafia, but that's exactly what they did here in this case.
And you think they got a bad reputation for that, like with the Endangered Species Act of trying to tell landowners what they're allowed to do with their own land. The thing is, if you want to have that kind of say, that's something you need that needs to be agreed upon when he bought the land in the first place. You can't come in and change the rules after the fact. And if you're so concerned about wetlands, buy them yourself, and then you can protect them all you want to. But you can't let people buy something and then come in afterwards and say, oh, wait, no, you can't do that. It's another way you hurt the economy. No one wants to set up shop somewhere because they're afraid the feds are going to come and shut it down for some random reason.
Yeah, but that just incentivizes people to go the other way, like you mentioned the Endangered Species Act. So if you're a developer or even just a guy who's going to build a house on your own property and you see this, you know, rare species of bird that's on the endangered list, what you're going to do is you're going to take the gun, you're going to shoot it, kill it, bury it somewhere, and hope that no one finds out.
Yeah, the old blowback argument. You try and use force to accomplish something, you're going to end up with the opposite result.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting about this is while the arguments were going on, it actually didn't look good for Kuntz for a while. And the justices, they kept saying, Kuntz's lawyers kept saying that they can't take the land, you know, under the Fifth Amendment without giving him just compensation, and they were arguing that preventing him from doing this is like a taking, but they kept asking, well, where's the taking? What was taken? And Scalia, who actually ended up voting in favor of it, kept asking over and over again. Every time they mentioned it was a taking, he kept saying, taking what? But when the other side was questioned by Justice Roberts, it kind of went the other way. Roberts asked if there's anything in the Constitution that limits the condition you can demand in exchange for granting a development permit. And at one point he asked, can you ask for the moon?
When they say taking what, if you own something but someone else gets to tell you what you're allowed to do with it, do you really own it?
It's kind of scary that the people in the Supreme Court don't quite understand that concept.
So what do you think? Is this a good decision?
Yes, leaning. Overall, I do think it is a win for property owners.
I don't know if they could have done any more, though, because it's not like they heard the facts of the case and were trying to judge on it, and I don't even think they have jurisdiction to do that. So I'm going to go with it's good.
Yeah, probably.
So the five who voted for it were Alito, Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. And voting against it was Kagan, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Aha, now we've come to Shelby County versus Holder. This is the one involving the Voting Rights Act that's got so many people who didn't actually read the decision into an uproar.
Those are always the fun ones, aren't they?
Shane, this opened the door for the return of the Ku Klux Klan to the South. What are you talking about?
All right, first things first. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed in reaction to racist policies that made it difficult for blacks to vote, as is their right protected by the 15th Amendment, so things like literacy tests or whatever. And so this act established federal oversight, which basically meant that any time a covered jurisdiction, meaning any state or locality with a history of voter discrimination, would have to get approval from the Department of Justice before implementing any change in their voting law. And in 2006, Congress extended this for another 25 years, but here's the thing. They didn't update the enforcement provisions, which means that all of the covered jurisdictions, no matter what their current situation has become, are judged by the same standards as existed 40 years ago. And this includes entire states like Alaska, Arizona, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. There are several other states with one or two jurisdictional exceptions, and also parts of Virginia and certain counties in various states. And not only that, but Congress actually added burdens onto these jurisdictions, despite the fact there have been these enormous improvements in African-American participation in the electoral process.
So you could make the argument at the time that this legislation was passed, perhaps it was needed. But I think at this point in 2013, some of these people, the way they were acting on Twitter, made it seem like within 24 hours you would once again have roving bands of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
And blacks would all of a sudden be ineligible to vote overnight, and that's not how it is.
No, and that's how officials in Shelby County, Alabama felt. They didn't think it was right that they were being held responsible for conditions that existed over 40 years ago. They argued that Sections 4 and 5 are unconstitutional. Section 5 is the requirement that they get pre-approval from the DOJ, And Section 4 is the one that sets out what jurisdictions are covered. And the way they determined this was they looked at the jurisdictions that were having this problem, the ones they wanted to cover, and they reverse-engineered a formula that would result in that, and that formula has not been updated. So in the court's opinion, they ruled, quote, "Despite the tradition of equal sovereignty, the Act applies to only 9 states and several additional counties, while one state waits months or years and expends funds to implement a validly enacted law, its neighbor can typically put the same law into effect immediately through the normal legislative process. Even if a non-covered jurisdiction is sued, there are important differences between these proceedings and preclearance proceedings. The preclearance proceeding not only switches the burden of proof to supplicant jurisdiction, but also applies substantive standards quite different from those governing the rest of the nation." And they went on to show statistics showing great improvement in these areas. And 4 years ago, after some people desperately accused me of racism, I made a video where I had one part I showed that in the former Confederate states, black people were elected to office pretty much in proportion to their population, while that wasn't the case anywhere else, so it just may be that elections are now more equitable in these areas.
Yeah, I mean, people really, like, the stuff they did back then, that was the social norm of the time. Nowadays, there is no way you'd get away without a massive upcry. I really don't see what people are getting all worried about.
Yeah, well, you had the dissent, very long-winded dissent from Ginsburg, which basically boils down to, "We trust Congress." The idea seemed to be that, well, the Voting Rights Act is the reason why all these improvements were taking place, and maybe it was, but she said, "It's like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet."
Yeah, I think it's more like, you had a sports team who was doing bad things or being penalized, but you've overlooked the fact now there's been a complete turnover since then. It's all different people, so you can't continue dinging them because they had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Well, and the justices who voted in favor of the ruling, they do acknowledge this happened in large part because of the Voting Rights Act, but there was nothing in the act that would recognize improvements and change the coverage. Quote, "In assessing the current need for a preclearance system that treats states differently from one another today, that history cannot be ignored. During that time, largely because of the Voting Rights Act, voting tests were abolished. Disparities in voter registration and turnout due to race were erased, and African Americans attained political office in record numbers. And yet, the coverage formula that Congress reauthorized in 2006 ignores these developments, keeping the focus on decades-old data relevant to decades-old problems rather than current data reflecting current needs."
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, you had the interwebs exploding, and there were a whole bunch of Twitter reactions. Jonathan, you mentioned one earlier. There was another one that said, quote, "In case you missed it, Shelby County, Alabama, claims racism doesn't exist anymore, and the Supreme Court agreed." And a personal friend of mine, I won't out him, but this is what he posted to Facebook. "So, the Supreme Court just decided that there's no more racial discrimination in the South. Okay, glad they think so." And of course, the opinion said precisely the opposite. They even acknowledged that the improvements were largely because of the Voting Rights Act. But I still don't see how that justifies making these jurisdictions abide by 40-some-year-old data based on discrimination that was committed by other people before many, if not most of them, were even born.
The silliest thing about it is this was not a problem caused by racism among the populace. It was racism in politicians doing this. So saying government was needed to protect against racism, just government were the ones who were doing the racism in this case in the first place. So it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, if you or I are racist and don't think blacks should be able to vote, there isn't thing one we can do about it unless we get into the government.
And if we do get into government, that would just be proof that government can't protect you from racism anyway.
Yeah.
Free at last, free at last. The South is finally free at last after 150 years of Northern occupation.
Well, maybe not, because all they did was they didn't rule Section 5 unconstitutional. They just ruled Section 4 was invalid because it hadn't been updated. And while that does invalidate the whole procedure for the time being, Congress could turn around and pass an updated version of it and come up with something that's hopefully at least a little more equitable.
I know racism is a volatile topic, but please, when you hear that word, resist the urge to just run in guns blazing. There's more to racism than just a bunch of good guys versus a bunch of bad guys.
So what would you say, good ruling or bad?
Oh yeah, definitely good.
Mm-hmm.
So voting for it were Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, Alito, and also Thomas wrote a separate opinion saying that if it were up to him, he would have found Section 5 unconstitutional as well. And voting against was Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Okay, now let's look at Hollingsworth versus Perry. This is the case that dealt with California's Proposition 8. That was an amendment to their state constitution that passed in November 2008 prohibiting gay marriage. Personally, I have a little bit of a sticking point about this because in May 2012, my home state of North Carolina shamefully passed a similar constitutional amendment. And when that happened, the internet exploded with, oh, people in North Carolina are just rednecks and hayseeds who marry their cousin and everything like that. And where was all of that when California passed Prop 8?
Doesn't count.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Like, didn't they do a...
Florida passed a similar thing the same year as California, so we were the ones getting the brunt then.
I just don't remember California getting attacked as much for some reason. But anyway, two same-sex couples challenged the amendment in federal court as unconstitutional under the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses. The state of California declined to defend the law. So ordinarily, that would have meant an instant win for them, but the California Supreme Court ruled that proponents of Prop 8 could step in and defend the law, even if the state of California was unwilling to do so, and therein lies the controversy. The district court allowed the defendants to come in and defend the case, but they ruled with the plaintiffs, showing that Prop 8 was unconstitutional on the grounds of due process and equal protection. The defendants appealed, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. So the court ruled, quote, federal courts have authority under the Constitution to answer such questions only if necessary to do so in the course of deciding an actual case or controversy. As used in the Constitution, those words do not include every sort of dispute, but only those historically viewed as capable of resolution through the judicial process. This is an essential limit on our power. It ensures that we act as judges and do not engage in policymaking properly left to elected representatives. For there to be such a case or controversy, it is not enough that the party invoking the power of the court have a keen interest in the issue. That party must also have standing, which requires, among other things, that it have suffered a concrete and particularized injury. Because we find the petitioners do not have standing, we have no authority to decide this case on the merits, and neither did the Ninth Circuit. So they have to demonstrate that they have been or will be harmed by the law or the action in question, and the proponents of Prop 8 just have no way at all to show that they're in any way being harmed by gay people getting married.
As usual, the anti-gay people have gotten nothing. No evidence, no harm, absolutely nothing.
Now, they didn't actually rule that Prop 8 was unconstitutional. They ruled that the petitioners did not have standing. Quote, we have never before upheld the standing of a private party to defend the constitutionality of a state statute when state officials have chosen not to. We decline to do so for the first time here, because petitioners have not satisfied their burden to demonstrate standing to appeal the judgment of the district court. The Ninth Circuit was without jurisdiction to consider the appeal. The judgment of the Ninth Circuit is vacated, and the case is remanded with instructions to dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction. So while they didn't actually rule it unconstitutional, the decision of the lower court that it's unconstitutional stands.
Well, it all helps.
Now, the dissents here seem pretty bogus to me, and they're saying things along the lines of, state governments shouldn't be able to nullify referenda from the people simply by choosing not to defend them in court. But the court didn't say that only the states could ever have standing. The two same-sex couples who initially brought the case had standing. They were harmed by the passage of Prop 8. It meant they couldn't get married. So if you can find people who are harmed by the overturning of Prop 8, then they would have standing, but I don't like gay marriage does not give you that standing.
Yes, indeed. Something a lot of people ought to learn.
So what do you think? Good decision or bad?
I'd say it's solidly in the good.
Overall good. Be nice if they could shoot down Prop 8, but I understand. We can't hope for too much.
Well, the lower court already did.
Yeah.
So voting for this was Ginsburg, Kagan, Breyer, Roberts, and Scalia. And voting against was Kennedy, Thomas, Alia, and Sotomayor. And now the moment you've all been waiting for, United States versus Windsor, the case surrounding the Defense of Marriage Act. So to understand what they did, we need to understand DOMA itself. DOMA has two sections that have the force of law. Section 2 gives the states the power to ignore same-sex marriages performed in other states. That was not under contention in this case. This case was about Section 3, which sets a federal definition of marriage as one man and one woman, meaning that same-sex spouses have no federal benefits. They can't file jointly for taxes. Same-sex military spouses and same-sex spouses of other federal employees don't get benefits, and so on. So the ACLU sued on behalf of a same-sex spouse whose inheritance from her deceased spouse was taxed as though they were unmarried. The case went to the Supreme Court. It was yet another 5-4 decision. But guess what? They ruled Section 3 of DOMA was unconstitutional. Can I get some applause here?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, they ruled that same-sex couples who are legally married by the laws of their state have all the privileges and protections the federal government grants to all married couples.
Definitely a step in the right direction.
Here's an interesting bit from the ruling. Quote, both the Justice Department and BLAG, that's Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, filed notices of appeal, and the Solicitor General filed a petition for, I don't know how to pronounce this word, certiorari, before judgment. The United States has not complied with the judgment. Windsor has not received her refund, and the executive branch continues to enforce Section 3 of DOMA. Now, what's interesting about this is what Attorney General Eric Holder said on February 23, 2011. Quote, the President has concluded that Section 3 of DOMA, as applied to legally married same-sex couples, fails to meet that standard and is therefore unconstitutional. Given that conclusion, the President has instructed the Department not to defend the statute in such cases. So, they came right out and said it's unconstitutional, we're not going to defend it, but then they continue to enforce it and defend it in court.
Need I say more? The Constitution only means what they want it to mean.
So, yeah, this speech got all sorts of applause from gullible Obamatons who listen to what his administration says, but doesn't pay too much attention to what they actually do. People do not give Obama any credit for this.
As far as I'm aware, Obama has never lifted a finger to defend gays in any way. He gave lip service to them when he was campaigning and then just kicked them all to the curb once he had what he wanted.
Who said it that all of the Obama's greatest accomplishments have been either by not doing anything when he quit enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, or when the Supreme Court has to do it for him?
Yeah. Well, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell was another thing that he kept fighting in court. Now, the main dissent here was delivered by Justice Scalia. I won't read any of it, but while I was reading it, the phrase butthurt kept coming to mind.
Very professional.
Oh, he was even engaging in ad hominem attacks against the court's majority.
Good Lord. Standards just won't stop falling.
I'm tempted to take 2 points away from him for that, but I'll stick to just taking one away.
To all the people who still preach the anti-gay message, it's already been pointed out you've got no evidence. But let's forget that for a moment. Let's say you're totally convinced that homosexuality is wrong. Even then, there is a very good reason that you should oppose them laws that restrict this. Because when government changes these laws or whatever, they're saying, you have our permission to marry these people or this person or to take this person as your lover. And you're a fool if you think they're going to stop there. You have given government their leg in the door on your own personal family life. What if someday down the road, some political busybody has a problem with your marriage in some way, thinks it's wrong for whatever reason? If that were to happen, tell me, on what grounds would you complain about it?
Good point. So am I right in thinking we're all saying this is a good decision?
Most definitely.
All right. Voting for it was Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Kagan, Breyer, and Kennedy. And against was Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas.
So what does that make the final score then?
At top we have Roberts and Kennedy with 3 points apiece. Then we have Alito, Thomas, Breyer, and Scalia with 1 point. Ginsburg and Kagan with minus one, and Sotomayor at the bottom with minus three.
So congratulations, everybody. You win. Oh, damn, we don't have anything, do we? Sorry, this is a low-budget operation.
They get 50,000 interwebs. Interwebs have no cash value and are not redeemable for anything. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting spread because it goes from minus three to plus three, and you kind of got people in the middle. And like I said, this week was slightly on the positive. We got more plus ones than minus ones and more plus threes than minus threes. But I don't know. I'm still thinking overall, statistically, it's a coin toss.
But how many of the people who scored positively voted in favor of silence being an admission of guilt now?
I'd have to go and look that up.
But that's just an interesting question. These people are not debating opinions. They're mulling over facts. So why is it always split like this? It should be unanimous. Like, you don't see 5-4 splits when scientists are working on theories, do you?
Well, I mean, you have controversies, and then they do the studies, and then they reach a consensus. And how many times does the Supreme Court actually reach a consensus? And think about this. They're looking at the facts of the case, and we saw several cases here today where the facts were not in dispute, so they're applying the law. These people are presumably the most brilliant legal jurists in the country. If they don't know the law, then who else can be expected to? And they still don't agree on it. It's still 5-4. These are the laws that you and I have to follow, and we're punished when we don't follow, and the Supreme Court can't even agree on them.
A law that you can't understand is worthless. Like, the rules should be something I could explain to your children, and they would understand perfectly.
You know, I think it's interesting, I was reading an article from Radley Balco. I don't believe any of the current Supreme Court justices have any experience as a criminal defense attorney. That, to me, is very scary. The fact that none of these guys have been on the opposite side of the courtroom arguing, saying this is why these protections are needed, you know, maybe then it might be easier. We might not have some of these seemingly pants-on-head decisions that might as well throw the Constitution in the fire.
Yeah, like when they elect a jury, don't they take great pains to get people from lots of different backgrounds so there's no all-white juries against a black guy and all that nonsense going on anymore?
Yeah.
So why exactly are juries being held to a higher standard than the Supreme Court? It doesn't make any sense.
Good question.
I need to figure this out, but I think there's actually only even two people on the Supreme Court currently who have actually argued a case in a courtroom. Think about that for a minute.
Okay, I got the answer to your earlier question there, Jonathan. The Salinas versus Texas case, the justices who voted in favor of that, who said your silence can be used against you, were Kennedy, Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. And the ones who voted against it were Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer. So that would have flipped the numbers a little bit more to the middle. They're basically centered around zero.
I'm even saying a coin flip.
We could replace the entire Supreme Court with a magic eight ball, and I don't think it would make any difference.
At least save a lot of time and money.
It'd be more efficient.
Well, that wraps up this Objection Sustained edition of the Bogosity Podcast. Please visit the forums at bogosity.tv, where you can read the show notes and join the discussion on these and other subjects. This podcast is free but not free to produce, so please donate via PayPal or Bitcoin at the top of the bogosity.tv website or down the right-hand side of the podcast page, and give generously to keep this podcast going. And if you'd like to contribute to the podcast, just send a question, statement, news article, or rant to podcast@bogosity.tv. Put it in an audio file, and if it's good enough, it'll get played right in the podcast. Thank you for listening, and thanks once more to my co-hosts, Tim Dyson and Jonathan Lochey.
Great to be back, and thank you for the scraps off the table, Supreme Court, for our precious bits of freedom.
Pleasure as always, and as I always say, be aware and be wise.
Until next time, here's a quote from Bob Inyart. It is not a justice system, it is just a system. The Bogosity Podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Imported License.
Bogosity.